Mentor promised Pipe a conduit to the purest crack the projects had ever seen. One night, they lockstepped to a meeting near the project's basketball court. BMO had been impressed over the past few months, seeing Pipe outsell many of the other kids on the block. He pointed out a silver Honda Accord. A man in his early 30s, dressed in a gray suit, sat at the wheel. It looked as though he had just left his office. Crackhead BMO introduced them. "This is my little man, Pipe. He's a good hustler." The man introduced himself as Ed. Pipe climbed into the front passenger seat, and BMO returned to the projects. Ed offered Pipe 14 grams of crack on consignment. Pipe promised to give him $400 in return in around a week's time. The boy stuffed the drugs into his pocket. He bought some small green bags at a bodega and bagged up the crack, potent and unadulterated, in his bedroom. Proudly he took to the block with his own crack, marked up in the distinctive green bags. Soon he had lines forming. Pipe made the $400 easily, put it aside, made another $400 to re-up for a second batch. He kept $400 profit for himself. He had reached a whole new level of financial success on his own. He lavished riches on his family. They ate Chinese takeout every night. His siblings could have McDonald's whenever they wished. Pipe opened a line of credit at a store on Cozy Corner so his siblings could always get candy. He generally kept his new wealth hidden under the sole of his sneakers. Sometimes, when he slept, his siblings crept in and snatched $100 bills. The drug that was destroying his mother was also the family's financial salvation. Yet his mother had been deeply involved in the drug game. He remembered one day back when he was 8, before he had begun selling crack. He had cut school to take care of his sisters. His mother left them at around 8:30 a.m., muttering something about her food stamps being terminated and needing to hustle up some money. As a rule, she forbade them from watching cartoons until 3. And around 11 that morning there was a knock on the door. Pipe tiptoed up to look through the peephole. He suspected a truancy officer. Instead, he saw the magnified, disheveled form of his mother slumped against the door. She clung to the walls as she staggered in, her face a bloody mess. "Don't cry," she whispered, seeing Pipe's face. She said she had been hustling heroin on the block when a rival crew abducted her. They took her to an apartment nearby, tied her up with duct tape, and demanded to know where her stash was. She refused to tell them. They pistol-whipped her, threatened to kill her, and then smashed her kneecaps with claw hammers. Still, she refused to yield. The men dragged her outside with the intention of taking her to the waste ground behind the projects and killing her. As they struggled to get her out the front door, her drug connection showed up and opened fire with a revolver. The men fired back. They dropped Pipe's mother and ran. Now she told him never to do business with anyone who would not look him in the eye. "You could see into a man's soul through his eyes," she said. "If he ever had doubts in the middle of a deal, or even later, he should trust his instincts and close the door," she told him. Thereafter he nursed a healthy distrust of everyone he met. But still, she refused to take any money from him. Pipe tried a different approach. He asked her to hold the money for him. She accepted, and eventually she dipped in, always apologizing when she did so. Pipe never asked for the money back. There were other avenues to get easy money and to test his growing power in the neighborhood. Pipe's 22 was an untapped conduit for cash. He and B-Love decided to stick up one of the 14-year-old kids from the Monroe Projects who had gotten jobs through the Summer Youth Employment Program. There was a check-cashing store near the Monroe Projects that the Summer Youth kids used. B-Love and Pipe waited on a corner and then jumped one of them, revealing the .22 revolver in Pipe's waistband. "Please don't shoot me," pleaded the boy. "I'll give you the money." He handed over his paycheck, $600 or $700, and ran home, too frightened to go to the police. Pipe was thrilled with what felt like a fortune. He didn't feel sorry for the victim, but he did feel his power increasing. By the early months of 1990, Pete and Pipe were together all the time. One day, Pete stopped by only to be intercepted by Pipe's mom. "Listen, my son got a lot of love for you," she told him, "and I hope you're the same with him." Pete declared that as far as he was concerned, Pipe was his brother. Pipe's mother launched into an inquisition. She elicited everything there was to know about Pete and what sort of boy he was. Only when she had finished did she call Pipe to announce Pete's arrival. When they got out on the street, Pete told his friend it felt like his mother had just put him on trial. A day or so later, Miss Annette called Pipe into her room and told him that she had spoken to Pete. She said that she trusted Pete, that likely he would be the first one to kill for Pipe. But, she predicted, he was all about himself. Sure, he wanted Pipe to get rich with him, but, she added sternly, Pete would never want Pipe to make more than him. Pipe filed the information before heading out the door. A few weeks later, Pete came striding up to 551 in a satin Sacramento Kings jacket, a purple baseball cap pulled low over his eyes. He had bought the new gear with the money he was generating from his Dominican contacts. He gathered everyone around him. "Yo, listen. We doing our own thing now," he said. "We ain't selling no blue tops with the lynch mob no more. We dealing our own work. We enterprising our own little clique. We need a name that supports the team." Pete felt they needed an alliance, not so much a gang, but a cabal dedicated to mutual economic advancement and self-protection. "We are Kings," he said. "It stands for Killing Innocent Niggas Gangsta Style." Within a week, Pipe had a purple satin jacket like Pete's. When the summer of 1990 rolled around, the Kings had earned no small degree of infamy, mostly from fistfights in the neighborhood. They cultivated their own myth. Pete shot a kid in the leg near the Stevenson Commons projects. He became known for carrying small-caliber pistols. One or two of the older gangsters on Cozy Corner called him Pistol Pete, and the name stuck. Pete and Pipe started hearing their stories told back to them. Pipe was at a party when some kids told him that they knew the reason he was called Pipe was because he had snuck up on someone and split open his skull with a lead pipe. He was more dangerous than even Pistol Pete, they said. 13-year-old Pipe chuckled to Pete. "We're blowing up, Mo." Mo had become a generic name for each other among the group. The name originated from the hoary street wisdom of crackhead Bimo. Like a medieval soothsayer using crack vials as runes, he flitted in the shadows of the neighborhood imparting his hard-won wisdom. Every hustler in the projects, from Fat Mike to Pipe, owed some of his success to Bimo's tutelage and connections. When he saw the King's jackets, he beckoned to Pipe from a vestibule. "Come and talk to Mo," he rasped. Soon they all called each other Mo. As their enterprise flourished, they didn't want to use government names or even street names, so Mo was perfect. In time it would be so distinctive that they could be in Brooklyn or Queens, and its use would indicate Bronx heritage. Crackhead Bimo observed the daily goings-on in the neighborhood like an anthropologist. One day he made a prophecy. In grave tones, he declared that Pete would eventually become a killer. "But he won't last long on the streets," Bimo predicted. On a balmy summer evening in 1990, the Kings strutted into the Monroe Projects for a block party. The sound system pulsed with Mob Style's gangster shit, a confection of piano breaks and break beats over an homage to Tech Nines, Hollow Points, and the high life of a drug dealer. The stabbing lines were delivered by an ex-dealer, A.Z. Faison, who, together with Rich Porter and Alpo Martinez from East Harlem, was once part of the most notorious cocaine triumvirate in New York City. Word of their exploits and wealth spread through the underground and the Bronx and Harlem projects, while their legends as benevolent revolutionaries taking on a white overclass grew. A.Z. Faison had survived a shooting in 1987, and Rich Porter was murdered by Martinez. An early influence on New York gangsta rap, AZ's urgent lyrics were meant to warn of the dangers of the game, but they were interpreted as glorifying them. On their way out, one of the Kings, Jasmine Total Package Mansell, known as TP, was taunted. "Well, hello, Jasmine," a Monroe youth teased with a lisp and a limp wrist. Pete ordered TP to stand up for himself by hurling an empty soda bottle. Another bottle came back in answer. One of the Monroe kids advanced. Then another bottle crashed near them, but this one sent shards of glass over Pipe's feet. Pipe caught Pete's smirk.
"Let him have it, Mo."
Pipe was already withdrawing the .22. He blasted at the boy not 5 feet away. The youth dived to the ground, panicked, and rolled over in a vain effort to dodge the shots. Bullets ricocheted off the ground, hitting his arms and legs. He yowled in pain. Pete and Pipe ran south to Soundview with one of the Monroe kids, armed in pursuit. They split up to throw him off. Pipe, still running, heard shots from somewhere in the night. Immediately, he feared Pete had been hit, and cursed himself for leaving him when only he had a gun and could have defended his friend if they'd stuck together. Pipe bumped into a kid in Soundview hit by a stray bullet, blood dripping from his hand, who said Pete was waiting for him at the Pink Circle, so called because of the pink picnic tables arranged around an 8-foot box ball court. Normally teeming with shouting kids, it was now eerily quiet. They stood beneath overhead lights around the swing set, and relief washed over Pipe when he saw Pete was unscathed. Pipe caught Pete looking at him with new respect. He gave Pipe a nod. The baby of the group, Pipe had passed an unofficial test. He had protected the crew. Pipe felt himself settling into his role, proud and secure. But at home, Pipe drifted into the dark side of his new character. One day at around 1 a.m., bored after a day hustling, Pipe and Roe were watching a movie. Roe drowsed, and Pipe's attention drifted until he saw a scene of some men playing Russian roulette with a revolver. Pipe woke his brother and asked if he wanted to play a game.
"Sure," said Roe. "What's it called?"
"Russian roulette." Roe looked uneasy. Pipe pulled out his .22 and explained further. "It's easy," he said, before offering a variation on the game. "I put one bullet in, and I spin it. I try to shoot you and see if there's a bullet there, and then you try to shoot me." Roe recoiled.
"I ain't going to play that."
Pipe ignored him.
"I'll go first."
Pipe slid a bullet into the chamber and spun the cylinder. Roe backed up to his bunk bed in horror. Without thinking, Pipe put the gun against his temple, jerked the trigger. A metallic click as the hammer hit an empty cylinder. Pipe sensed himself waking as if out of a trance. What had he just done? Roe burst into tears. "You crazy!" Pipe looked down at him, the revolver at his side, and fought a growing wave of revulsion.
"I ain't crazy, nigga," he thundered. "You can't be scared to die. Know why? Because when you scared, that's when you die."
He put the revolver away and climbed into bed, but lay awake a long time, trembling. It felt like he'd been momentarily possessed. Pipe found himself brooding on his own mortality whenever he was alone. He had concluded that one way or another, he was going to be murdered. If he washed up dead, he realized, no one would care. He'd just be another dead black kid in the projects, and life would go back to normal for everyone. So, he reasoned, if he couldn't allow himself the luxury of being scared of dying, he had to go in the other direction. He had to laugh in the face of death. 6. The Birth of Sugar Shaft. The white stone facade of the Spofford Juvenile Center filled the windshield of the prison bus. Sean and other youths, shackled in one of the rear seats, passed under gates topped with barbed wire, which at night were bathed in the glow from powerful spotlights. The 8-story prison sat on top of a small hill in Hunts Point, surrounded by auto shops and collapsing wooden buildings. In the breeze, plastic bags snagged and slowly ripped to tendrils on the barbed wire-topped fences that hemmed in the prison. Built in 1957, Spofford was established to turn recalcitrant teenagers straight. Sean knew it as a place where young men got raped. He balled up his fists,
put on his fiercest scowl, and declared to himself that if any motherfucker laid a hand on him, he was going to kill him. Sean was 15. He had dropped out of school to jump into the burgeoning crack business. Soon after that, he had developed a crush on Shakira, the girlfriend of the dealer Lester, who had returned a year or two after the furor over Fat Mike's murder had died down. Lester and Shakira supplied him with crack. A stunning red-bone, light-skinned and mixed race, Shakira had watched Sean beat up kids from her building at the behest of Fat Mike. She flirted with him, bought him sneakers sometimes.
"Your little ass going to be a problem when you older," she told Sean, smiling and wagging a finger.
Despite his toughness, Sean had a little boy lost vulnerability about him that women found irresistible. Shakira took advantage of his belligerence to punish a kid who hadn't made good on some crack she wanted him to sell on consignment. Sean caught the boy outside the Sackwern houses, knocked him down, stomped on him, and left. Afterward, Shakira bought him his first beeper, the totem of a successful dealer. Once he went back to re-up from her, and ended up staying the night. He was slumbering when he caught sight of her naked in her bedroom, her door slightly ajar. He crept closer and watched from the shadows as her dealer boyfriend made vigorous love to her. His arousal quickly subsided to a deep and angry covetousness. But at 6:30 p.m. on a July evening in 1988, after a successful day selling on Cozy Corner, half a dozen plainclothes police officers pounced, slamming him against a wall. At the 43rd Precinct on Fatelli Avenue, Sean's first thoughts focused on the certain wrath of Miss Julia. A few months earlier, she had found crack vials in his closet and flushed them down the toilet. When she arrived at the precinct, she stood over Sean, shackled to the bench in the general waiting area. "I should leave you here," she said, pacing up and down in front of him, her gold jewelry glinting in the drab precinct house. Sean lowered his head. A couple of the other drug dealers snickered at the sight of the little old lady humbling a boisterous hustler. Shortly thereafter, Sean admitted his guilt and was sentenced to 18 months in Spofford. The children's prison smelled like a mausoleum. Jewelry was not allowed officially, but once he joined the general population, Sean discovered that the rules didn't apply to the tougher kids, the ones in for murder. They flaunted their gold fronts, teeth encased in gold. Some of the guards were from the same neighborhoods as the inmates and knew not to mess with the kids who had connections outside. Behind the military-style structure at Spofford, it was turmoil. Children were discovered dead after assaults. Staff sometimes escorted kids to different parts of the prison to fight other kids. Female prisoners were sexually abused by counselors while shackled. Roaches ran amok in the kitchens. More than 50 children tried to commit suicide in a single year. Inmates organized themselves by neighborhood into warring tribes. Children from only 15 of New York City's 59 districts, the poorest neighborhoods in the city, made up half the admissions, with Soundview heavily represented. Sean quickly aligned himself with his brethren. Up on the top tiers, from certain wings, you could see all the way east across the Bronx River and the park to the tops of the Soundview houses and home. After several weeks, the prison transport took him to the Tryon School for Boys in a lush valley northwest of Albany. Sean was placed in Barkwood, just one of a scattering of one-story cottages with sylvan names that housed kids from all over New York City, most from inner-city housing projects. Many suffered from mental illness. When one of the counselors invested special care in him and took him fishing, which Sean loved, all he could do was scan the river and the roads for a possible escape route back to the Bronx. He yearned for the Soundview community. Without his tribe in Soundview, he felt naked, alone, and vulnerable. After a year or so, Sean was placed in a group home near East 233rd Street in the Bronx, a transition point back into society. Miss Julia gave him money to buy boots, pants, and a new sweatshirt. Instead, he blew all the money on a New York Jets starter jacket. He had it for a few weeks before a gang from the Edenwald houses beat him to the ground and stole it.
One weekend leave, he came home to Miss Julia and decided not to return to the group home. A few days later, there was a loud knock on the door. Group home supervisors and a federal marshal entered the apartment, and before Sean could move, he was on the floor, face pressed into the carpet in his room as handcuffs bit into his wrists. Marched into the living room, he berated Miss Julia. "Why you open the door to them, Mama?" Miss Julia, flustered in the commotion, said, "I ain't know who these motherfuckers was." Sean returned to Spofford for 30 days of further punishment. The brutality of his confinement hardened him, inculcating a deeper understanding of the power and worth of violence, and a hunger for money from the drug game. Sean returned to Soundview in mid-1990, proud to have graduated from Spofford in the same way a boastful young man in his 20s might brag about a degree from Yale. Pipe saw Sean on the block and noted that his friend had a stiffer posture, a rougher manner, and a more defiant look now. Sean asked for money to get started in the game again, and Pipe lent it to him. The neighborhood had turned more violent since Sean had been away. E-40, Sean and Pete's unofficial boxing coach, had been shot and killed during Sean's absence. The boys were shaken by the loss. Everywhere the shootings between dealers intensified. Sean was playing Skelsies when Lester was shot in the backside, and Pipe's dad, home from a prison stretch, ran in and carried him to safety. Out on the block, there were so many kids selling crack it seemed impossible to make money. Soon after his release, Sean bumped into Baby Jay, a round-faced older boy with soft, expressive eyes who had lost his mother in 1985. Baby had lived with Sean and Miss Julia for a few months after her death. He wasn't a scrapper or a gunbuster, but he was part of the Boobies, a semi-official crew that counted Sean among its affiliates. The Boobies had a reputation for using cocaine as well as selling it. Baby was savvy. When Sean complained that it had been hard to make money on Cozy Corner since his release, Baby suggested that he accompany him to Springfield, Massachusetts, where the business was just getting started. He'd written to Sean in Spofford about how much money he was making in New England. But he'd been robbed a couple of times, beaten up, and needed protection. He knew Sean was drawn to the role of protector and enforcer. A couple of days after their reunion, Sean stood outside his building, his hair glistening in a newly styled afro, as Baby circled the block in a black Volkswagen Corrado. Baby had dressed all in black to match his car. Together, they slipped onto the Bruckner Expressway and then onto I-95, speeding all the way. The industrial gray topography of the Bronx soon gave way to a New England fall of exploding auburns and russets. I-95 was a road paved with gold for drug traffickers. The farther north you went, the more contraband was worth. From New Haven, they swung directly north up I-91 along the Connecticut River. Spofford and Tryon disappeared from Sean's mind, and he was free to listen to Mary J. Blige on the car radio and imagine his riches. Sean had just $20 in his pocket, and they had just an ounce of crack in the glove compartment to get them started. But it was enough. "I'd die for you two times, Baby Jay," Sean shouted over the music. "You my heart. No one messes with you now. You got me to hold you down." He turned to Baby Jay and whooped that he was going to get rich, rich. "I'm a blow-up." 3 hours later, the black Volkswagen rolled through the center of a New England city decimated by industrial decline. Springfield once prospered as the industrial beehive, home to companies such as Indian Motorcycles and other manufacturers who drew workers from all over the country, even Puerto Rico. But by the early 1980s, factory bosses were moving their operations to the non-unionized South or outsourcing overseas. The legions of unemployed meant it was fertile ground for a crack operation. Baby pulled up outside 85 College Street, a three-story colonial. He introduced Sean to a 79-year-old Italian grandmother who sold crack from a threadbare couch. She took an immediate dislike to Sean, but grudgingly let him stay. Afterward, in a back room, Baby wasted no time slicing crack into $20 hunks with a razor blade on an old plate, putting the rocks into bags. When he finished, there were 200 small bags. He gave Sean 50 and said that they would share it 60-40. Baby took Sean a couple of blocks over to Cambridge Street. Within 15 minutes, Sean sold all of it and made $120. In New York, it would have taken him half a day. Over the next few weeks, Sean met the local hustlers who admired Sean's Pelly-Pelly jacket and his New York swagger and asked if he had met any of the famous rappers like Nas. Sean preened. "I might have," he lied, the embodiment of the urban dealer. Sean noticed that the local Springfield hustlers wore tattered sneakers and old Patrick Ewing streetwear, gear that would have been scorned in Soundview, the mark of a chump who didn't know how to make money. Here, free of the fierce competition and out from under the shadows of powerful dealers in Soundview, where he was just another nondescript teenage hustler at their beck and call, Sean began to like the backwater city more and more. He sensed he might stand out here, in a place where he could be special. By early 1991, Sean and Baby were counting out tens of thousands of dollars, money for re-ups as well as profit from the past 6 months. To celebrate Sean's 17th birthday in February and his own 18th in March, Baby paid cash for a brand-new silver Isuzu Rodeo SUV. He spent another $8,000 on leather seats and a sound system. Baby gave his Volkswagen to Sean as a low company car, one that would not attract suspicion, partially as a birthday present for his enforcer's personal use, but really so Shug could transport drugs for him. Shug read this as pure generosity. When his mother died, Baby used her life insurance money to buy drugs, and now he was quickly doubling it. Sometime in spring 1991, they drove to Soundview to re-up. Sean had $4,000 in his back pocket, Baby 10 times that. They spent the weekend lavishing money and affection on girls in Soundview before returning to Massachusetts with 2 kilos of cocaine in the SUV. "I need to give you a nickname, man," said Baby as they sped through Connecticut. "We can't be out there using our government names, everybody calling you Sean and all that." Sean, chomping on a candy bar, acknowledged the idea. He had spent the weekend smoking weed and was ravenous. Chocolate had become a staple of his diet since he started making money. "I'm going to call you Sugar Shaft." Sean absorbed his new moniker. "Sugar, 'cause you always hyper and eating candy," said Jay. "And Shaft, because you always wants to fight or do something to somebody. You a gangster." Sean's transformation to gangster enforcer was complete. He had been reborn. He mouthed the words, looking out the window, the first greenery of spring flashing past. "Sugar Shaft. Sugar Shaft." When the grandmother was arrested, Baby left Shug, as Sugar Shaft became known, in charge of the house, which now swarmed with crack addicts every day. Baby removed himself out of harm's way to a quiet, well-appointed condo. Shug wasted no time in filling the rooms with friends from Soundview who brought up guns and swelled the crew, taking over the entire block, while helping to pitch crack in the area. Shug served crackheads from his bedroom window until Baby told him not to. He shot guns in the air from the backyard until Baby again begged him not to draw attention to the house. In the summer of 1991, the group of dealers went to Six Flags New England, a giant amusement park near the Connecticut border. They drove to Atlantic City and blew their money in casinos. They sunned themselves at Virginia Beach. Shug returned to Soundview like a victorious crusader. He ran into Pipe and flaunted his new gangster alter ego. When Pipe called him Sean, he corrected him irritably. "I'm Sugar Shaft now, yo, so call me Shug." Pipe had never seen such a transformation. At first, Pipe thought Sean was bullshitting. Before he left, he'd just been a slightly rough neighborhood kid who begged for money and borrowed Pipe's clothes to impress the girls. Now, here he was in a blazing white outfit, wearing brand-new Nikes and with a completely different swagger. He pimp-rolled like a gangster now. He threw Pipe $150 as a gift. Plenty where that came from, he bragged. And when Lester demanded the money from the crack he had given him on consignment, Shug rounded on him, smoldering with defiance. Lester pulled back, seeing something altogether darker in Shug's eyes. For his part, Shug came to the realization that money brought respect, and his possession or lack of it became linked with his self-esteem. He had a dazzling gold ring embossed with a large J made for Miss Julia's birthday in May. She grudgingly accepted it, but once again refused money. Shug discovered that when she went to the numbers spot near Cozy Corner, she took cash with her. He would follow her in, stuffing money into her pockets while she played. She pretended not to notice. Returning to Springfield in late July, they learned that they'd become targets. Their growing affluence and Shug's conspicuous and wayward nature had drawn the attention of local crews. One of the Brockites in the house got pistol-whipped before thieves made off with drugs and money. Shug exploded. "If it's these Springfield niggers, I'm going to start shooting every one of them." But if all their newfound wealth was drawing the attention of gangs in Springfield, it was also certainly drawing the attention of vengeful Bronx gangsters who resented these triumphalist teenagers flashing money in Soundview. In September 1991, Shug was back in Soundview, speeding around the neighborhood on a lime-green Kawasaki dirt bike. He whipped around the Soundview Horseshoe one more time before blasting into Soundview Park. Life in that moment was perfect. He'd bought the bike for cash. He had $1,200 jammed in the back pocket of his brand-new pants, and he wore a new Yankees baseball cap. He had left his .45 at his grandmother's because Jay had told him not to ride around with it. Shug popped a wheelie, grabbed the clutch, and with the front brake engaged, spinning the bike in ever-faster circles, burned a smoking circle with his rear wheel on the pavement. With that, he took off down Randall toward the Bronxdale houses to Baby's grandmother's apartment. Feathering the clutch and the throttle, he popped another wheelie as he flew past the Monroe houses. "Suckers!" he yelled at some kids on the corner. He didn't notice a white car trailing him. At the Bronxdale houses, he cut the motor and glided to a stop, resting the bike against the wall. He bounded up two steps before he felt a heavy hand on his shoulder. He turned to see Chiron Little. "What up, Chiron?" said Shook amicably. He and his grandmother had known him for years. "What do you mean, what up?" Chiron said, sneering. Shug saw a fist cloud his vision before he was knocked back. When he regained his balance and eyesight, he saw another man producing a machine gun. He jammed the muzzle into Shug's back. Now Chiron pulled a semi-automatic pistol out of the front of his pants and aimed it at Shug. Slowly, E.T. Larry alighted from a car parked in front. His pit bull panted heavily in the passenger seat. "Get in," he ordered. 7. Kidnapped. Blood begets blood. Shug's legs buckled. As he tried to regain his balance, he touched his hand to the crown of his head and brought it down to see his fingers were covered in blood. Moisture began seeping from the wound, soaking his scalp and running into his eyes. He'd been hit with the heavy milled steel of a pistol butt. After an interrogation in E.T. Larry's car, the men had marched Shug up a concrete ramp outside the Bronxdale houses, through the lobby, and into the cramped elevator, where they had smashed him over the head. Surrounded by the most feared gangsters in Soundview, he had 4 gun barrels trained on him. His assailant, Lance, was rippling with muscle after his recent release from prison. Facing him was E.T. Larry himself, a tall man with skin the color of buttery caramel and an oddly squeaky voice that didn't match his formidable presence. Chiron and another man, Guidry, were jammed in, too. Shug dropped somewhere between a cower and a crouch, protecting his head from another pistol whipping. "What the fuck you doing, yo?" he implored. "Shut up," thundered Chiron. "What floor Jay live on? We know he got money. That's your man. Where his money at?" Shug shook his head and played dumb. "What you talking about?" He dropped his hands in supplication, spreading his palms. The move left his head unprotected. Chiron hit him with a gun. Blinded by the pain, Shug made a commotion in a futile attempt to draw attention. He realized that they were probably going to kill him. He remembered Fat Mike and the black body bags coming out after the robbery. Shug fell to his knees, crying. He begged them to stop.
"Chiron, man, what's wrong?" he implored. "Chiron, please, please, what did I do?"
Lance yanked Shug to his feet and pinioned his arms behind his back. The men stabbed at elevator buttons, ignoring his cries for mercy. Jay lived on the fourth floor. They moved past it.
"It's here,"
lied Shug, indicating the fifth floor. The men stopped the elevator. They dragged him into a dimly lit hallway. The gangsters demanded to know which apartment was Baby's. Shug indicated the first door that he saw.
5D.
Lance released him before shoving him in the back as the others encircled him from behind, pushing him up to the door as they raised their guns. Anyone inside would only see Shug through the peephole, not the gun-wielding gangsters. Shug knocked weakly a few times. The men pushed forward on either side of him, ready to fire. Shug knew he'd be hit in the crossfire once they opened the door. In a split second, he realized he had one slim chance of escape. He edged back toward the elevator and bolted, hurtling toward the stairwell at the end of the corridor. He exploded out the landing door and found himself in the stairwell. Leaping down each flight, his feet barely touched the steps. Outside, he ran for his life, weaving, sprinting back to Soundview, his face a mask of blood. At some point, he stopped and paged Baby J. Baby didn't page back. Shug felt the need to pray to God, something he hadn't done since he had been to church with Miss Julia. He swore that he would never get involved in drugs again if God could help him out of this mess.
"Please, God, spare my life. I don't want the drug game anymore. If you let me live, I'll never sell drugs again."
He slowed down his stride. Beyond God, there was one person he could turn to in crisis, Pistol Pete, whose home was about a mile and a half away. Shug broke right on Story Avenue and surged toward Boynton Avenue. Gasping for air, he fell onto the intercom at 875, smearing it with blood as he jabbed at Pete's apartment number. Shug could barely muster the breath to say his name before Pete clicked the buzzer. He burst inside, and seconds later collapsed on Pete's floor. In deep, halting breaths, he got the story out. Pete led Shug to the sofa where he examined the head wound. As Shug looked up through a veil of blood, he saw Pete's eyes moisten before hardening again. He ordered his girlfriend to get gauze, peroxide, and some of his mother's painkillers. She mopped up the blood and applied the gauze. Pete soothed his friend.
"I love you, Mo," he said. "You my man. Ain't nothing going to happen to you."
Pete disappeared and returned with his Tech 9 and two loaded magazines.
"Ain't no one ever going to do this to you again," he said, racking the slide for full effect. "What do you want to do?"
Shug didn't hesitate.
"I want to kill every single one of those motherfuckers."
Pete sat down next to Shug and handed him a 9mm Luger with a complicated safety.
"I can give you this," he said.
Shug looked at the 9mm bullets. He thought about it for a while.
"Ain't you got nothing bigger?"
Pete left and returned with a 30-30 sawed-off lever-action rifle he had christened Betsy, the same one he had once offered Pipe the chance to shoot. The 30-30 rounds were three times as big.
"I want that," Shug said.
E.T. Larry and his men were considerably older than Pete and the boys. They had a sizable arsenal and, crucially, money. They could pay others to kill on their behalf. As Pete understood it, E.T. Larry was looking to take over the entire drug trade in the projects. If Pete countered with more violence than E.T. Larry, the fiefdom of Soundview would be theirs. Shug saw only Pete's loyalty to him, giving little consideration to the bigger picture. With its dense clusters of projects, the South Bronx was heating up. Dealers saw the money that could be made not just by controlling their own buildings, but by taking over others. Cops like Forselli ran from one project to another trying to deal with what seemed like a tidal wave of shootings. In the Edenwald houses, the authorities installed a permanent office to deal with the escalating violence. Pete telephoned every gunbuster he knew in the hope of forming a small army. Baby arrived from Springfield, assessing the situation. He and Pete loathed each other, but the seriousness of events demanded they be allies. He left to get more guns. As they waited for friends to show, Pete changed his mind and opted for surprise, sudden and vicious retaliation. "We ain't got to wait for nobody, man," he said, pacing up and down. "Let's go shoot them in the face right now." He strapped on a bulletproof vest and pulled on an olive-green army jacket with a hood over it. He threw Shug a similar jacket but had no more bulletproof vests. They headed to the block to meet two friends. One of them, Dustcan, had been riding Shug's dirt bike earlier in the day. Shug told the story. He pulled down his hood to reveal the gash and gauze. Shug and the other boys all knew Chiron. Shug handed one of the men $300 from a roll in his pocket. "Keep an eye on us," he said. "We're going to kill them." It was an unnecessary gesture, but the youth pocketed the money anyway. As they were talking to Dustcan, Shug did a double take when Lance, the man who had held his arms behind his back and hit him, appeared across the projects, only 40 feet away. "That's fucking Lance right there," Shug exclaimed, eyes wide. Pete barely turned his head. "Let's kill him," Shug said, bouncing his weight from foot to foot. Pete resisted. "Nah, chill." He had worked out the odds of reaching Lance before Lance spotted them and returned fire. He figured that their best chance lay in catching Lance inside, where he could be cornered. Shug couldn't wait, couldn't stand to see Lance walking away. "Yo, fuck this! What you mean, wait?" He set out after Lance at a mad run, wrestling the 30-30 from his pants leg. Behind, he heard muffled shouts from Pete, "Wait!" Shug jumped a small chain-link fence. Lance turned and saw his flailing pursuer and broke into a sprint. Pete gave up trying to dissuade Shug and simply followed him. Shug bore down. In his peripheral vision, he saw a few mothers pulling their children away or shielding them, people pulling their heads back into windows, and he squeezed the trigger. He was about 30 feet away. The sound of the big gun echoed around the buildings. He missed. He flicked the lever forward and reloaded, fired again, and missed again. Pete came from behind, cutting off Lance's retreat into a building entrance, and opened up with the Tech-9, firing from a moving crouch as he and Shug pincered in on Lance. Staccato riffs from the machine gun echoed off the red brick. Shug shot all 5 rounds from the 30-30. Lance, grazed by one of Pete's bullets, slipped and fell, trying to dodge follow-up shots as Pete moved up to finish him off. Just as he neared, police sirens wailed. Flashing blue lights reflected off the project windows. The boys paused, which gave Lance the opportunity to tear into his building. Pete and Shug fought the urge to run as the police converged in the distance. They turned calmly back and walked past two boys who had been trading rhymes and had witnessed the shooting. "Sup," Pete said. "Anyone seen us?" "Nah, Petey, we ain't seen nothing." But the police had spotted them. They split up. Shug raced toward Cozy Corner, while Pete ducked back through the labyrinthine buildings, his familiarity with them giving him an edge over the pursuing cops, as he jetted through one building and out the back door into another. As Pete remembers it, he emerged on the northern edge of the projects, opposite PS-107, and into the waiting arms of two police officers with their revolvers trained on him. He pointed the Tech-9 at them.
"Drop your gun!"
they shouted. Pete looked at their old revolvers and held fast.
"No, you drop yours."
The police hesitated, which gave him a split second to dodge back into the building. He ducked into the stairwell and ran up to the roof. Atop every apartment block was a rectangular housing that contained the winches for the elevator. He deposited 2 magazines on top of the housing, climbed down, and hurled the gun off the edge of the building where it landed in some bushes below. Coming back down the stairs, he paused and saw an open apartment door on one of the floors and charged inside. The kid living there recognized him. Pete explained the situation, and the kid gave him a new shirt and a baseball cap. They left the apartment together and waited for a full elevator before descending to the lobby amid the scrum of other residents. The police were waiting. They warned everyone that there was a man with a gun in the building and that residents should evacuate until the situation was resolved. Pistol Pete, unrecognized, filed out of the building with everyone else. The scene played out like an escape in one of the gangster movies Pete had spent so many afternoons watching. Pipe was circling the area on a bicycle drawn by the sound of gunshots. About an hour later, he caught sight of Pete sitting outside the garage at his grandmother's house on a plastic chair, gazing into the projects. Pete was proud of his escape. He asked Pipe to take his bike and locate the gun he threw off the roof. Pipe cycled down. He found the gun and the magazines and returned to Pete's, triumphant. They went to the roof of 551, just above their hustle spot, where Pete gave the gun a short burst to test it. The bullets flew toward the horizon over Manhattan. The lineaments of Pete's face tautened when he told Pipe about Shug's kidnapping and how he was going to retaliate. He waxed about his childhood with Shug, their time on the Young Devils team. Shug may have been selling drugs, but he was not known as a gangster in Soundview. Pete was not doing this for Baby Jay. The two had long nursed a distrust of each other. Pete was doing it for Shug, but even Pipe knew he was doing it, above all, for himself. Pipe looked down into the red brick canyons of Soundview. In the darkness, high above the rooftops, he watched his old friend happily imagining the battle that might soon take place below. The following day, Pete and a few others bought new guns from some Dominicans in Manhattan, rejecting an offer of some hand grenades. Returning to Soundview, they attempted to ambush E.T. Larry, but Baby Jay stumbled into the path of B-Love and, while blocking him, was unable to fire his gun for some reason, and they had to pull back. Pete ordered that Baby stay away from the next attempt. 24 hours later, Pete, B-Love, and Pipe congregated outside 551 with a few others. E.T. Larry and his men huddled near the entrance of 1725, their headquarters, which was also the building where Shug lived with his grandmother. Because he could no longer return to his apartment safely, Shug holed up with Baby in Manhattan, returning only to carry out shootings with Pete and the others. The two sides kept an unwavering eye on each other like World War I soldiers facing off across the trenches at Ypres, the central median, a no-man's land. Pete and his men controlled the way into the Soundview houses at 551 on the southern side of the horseshoe, while E.T. Larry and the others at 1725 controlled the way out. Sometime in the afternoon, an emissary came over and told Pete that E.T. Larry wanted to meet. Pete, Pipe, and 8 or 9 others chambered their guns before walking over. When they got closer, they could see that their enemies were armed, too. E.T. Larry spoke first. "We ain't got no beef with you," he said to Pete. Pete was unmoved. He knew they were scared of his father and his uncle and the forces he could muster. "Shug is my little man," he said. "You got a beef with him, you got a beef with me." "It ain't got nothing to do with you," E.T. Larry said before adding that he considered Pete a friend of sorts. "You is people's. It's Baby Jay and them." Pete shook his head. They headed back toward 551. Pipe made sure not to turn his back fully on E.T. Larry and his men. "Did you hear what they did to poor little Sean?" Pipe's aunt asked one of the neighbors as word of the dispute spread around the project. According to Shug, the projects were siding with Pete's crew. Pete's apartment became the unofficial HQ for the war. Pete, Shug, and B-Love whiled away the rest of the daylight hours, curtains drawn, watching Scarface, munching on chips and checking their guns. Pete scorned Shug's impulsiveness, deriding him as a loose cannon for blowing their one chance at Lance by attacking before they were ready. Shug spent most of his time on the balcony, smoking weed. The smoke blew back into the apartment. Pete hated it.
"How you niggers gonna get money when you give all your money to the weed man?" he scolded.
Pete regarded drinking and smoking weed as signs of weakness. His only vice was apple-flavored bubble gum. As dusk fell beyond the curtains, Pete's phone rang. The caller said that E.T. Larry and the others were standing under Pete's window. Pete suggested to them all that they attack from the side, not from the direction of 551. E.T. Larry and his men would be expecting that. Shug would be with him, while B-Love would come up from the south, cutting off their escape. Shug nodded, though he didn't like taking orders. He tried to focus on the prospect of killing the men who had held him captive. Dressed in army jackets and dark clothes, they made their way out of Pete's apartment like a nighttime platoon. There was the occasional clink of metal in the darkness as a gun hit a belt buckle or a fastener as they crept through a parking lot and then slipped up to 551, where Pipe and the others were keeping watch. Pipe, smoking a blunt, didn't notice the shrouded figures moving up on his position and pouncing out of the night.
"You slippin', Mo," Pete snapped hotly, throwing his hood back. "If we was one of them, you'd be dead."
Pete told Pipe the plan. Pipe suggested that if E.T. Larry and the others escaped south toward 551, then he and his boys would cut them down. In the past few months, Pipe had amassed a sizable arsenal, and he had stored most of the guns at 639 Rosedale Avenue, where his mother now lived. Her building stood behind 1725, E.T. Larry's HQ. Pipe headed off, discreetly circling 1725. While the others waited downstairs, Pipe and two associates let themselves into his mother's apartment. He unlocked the door to his room and got down on the floor to reach under the bunk beds for the duffel bag. He climbed to his feet and turned to find his mother standing over him.
"What you got in the bag?"
"Nothing."
"I can't have you bringing no guns in my house," she said.
Pipe mumbled something about removing them all now.
"You know I can't tell you what to do," she said, giving him a hard stare. "You're going to do what you're going to do, but it's a dangerous game. You've seen what happened to me."
Back then, he thought, when he'd first seen his mother bloody and broken, he might have stepped away from this life. But not now. Shug and Pete needed him. She added contemplatively,
"You my son. My firstborn. I love you."
The words mollified Pipe.
"I would hate to see anything happen to you, and I would hate to see you locked up for the rest of your life."
Pipe stood with his arms by his sides. The bag of guns suddenly grew impossibly heavy. He saw the resignation in her face. His mother sighed. She knew that where there was drug money, violence would follow. She could offer him lofty morals, or she could be practical. She chose the latter.
"If this is what you choose to do," she said, "then make sure you do it to the best of your ability, because if you go in half-stepping, then ain't nothing gonna come of it. You're gonna end up hurt or going to jail. If you're gonna go in, then make sure you go in all the way. Know the consequences of it."
She paused and softened.
"Look, I'd rather see you in jail than dead."
She asked if he understood what she had meant, but she didn't have to. "If you're going to be shooting people, then make sure you kill them so they can't come back and kill you. Know what I'm saying?"
Pipe nodded.
"All right, Ma," he said. "I hear you."
He made his way out the front door, stuffing a revolver in his pants. He was halfway across the median, his head down, thinking about what his mother had said, when he slipped under a couple of trees and drew level with the bodega on the corner. He hadn't noticed the figures looming in front of him, one brandishing a Glock, the other a small machine gun. Lance and Chiron blocked his route. Caught unawares, Pipe was unable to reach his gun.
"You like shooting people, little nigger," said Chiron, gesturing with his gun in Pipe's face.
Lance had survived Pete's attack the previous night. He was enraged. Pipe looked for a car to take cover behind, anything, even a tree. His mouth turned dry. He couldn't form words. A pang of dread spiraled up his spine. The men watched him. They knew who Pipe's father was, that he held sway in the projects, and gunning down a 14-year-old was a risky move.
I ain't gonna kill you now, Chiron said. I'm gonna kill you later.
They paused after the warning and then moved off. Pike bolted to 551 and breathlessly spilled out what had happened. He could see in the darkness Pete's silhouette bracing with fury. When he finished, Pete silently pulled on a bulletproof vest, racked the slide on his gun, and set off with Shug and Belove. They crept north, hugging the buildings. Up ahead, Pete spotted E.T. Larry and the others.
"Yo, let's get 'em,"
he whispered, pulling the Tech-9 from his book bag. Shug stole a glance. E.T. Larry and the others were smoking less than 100 feet away. Pete, the only one protected by a bulletproof vest, urged them to move in for the attack, to run and gun.
"Yo, Pete," Shug whispered, "how come you the only one with the vest on? Why don't you run up and shoot them in the face? We'll hold you down." "So I gots to do everything then?"
Pete said irritably.
"Like, you know what? Y'all leave and I'll do everything."
Shug didn't want to argue. It was his beef. Pete was doing this for him, and he had no real right to protest. Pete and Shug wouldn't lead the charge as they were the fastest runners. Belove would provide covering fire. Pete and Shug walked two abreast. Their targets weren't paying attention.
"Guess what?"
shouted Pete. They turned, agape. From 10 feet away, Pete swung the gun up, squeezed the trigger. Nothing. Just an oily click. At Pete's house, another boy in the crew, Nugent, had taken the bullet out of the chamber and not replaced it. Without the first round in the chamber, it would not fire or feed rounds. The silence resounded around them. Pete retreated, struggling with the gun's mechanism.
"Oh, shit, my gun's jammed," he said over and over again.
Shug sprayed fire with the MAC-10 he'd been given, saving Pete and forcing E.T. Larry and his men to the ground for cover. He struggled to contain the recoil. Behind him, Belove opened up with the 30-30. Pete loaded the Tech-9. Now he, too, let loose a barrage. The men got to their feet, but Chiron flailed and fell back to the ground. He pulled out a gun and shot back. A couple of rounds whined past Shug's ear.
"Yo, Petey, we need to fall back,"
shouted Shug over the racket. Pete refused.
"No, we gonna get them."
More bullets flew their way. They ran in retreat, Pete and Shug taking cover behind a corner. Pete had second thoughts.
"What the fuck we running for?" he spat. "We got guns."
But their hesitation emboldened E.T. Larry and Chiron, who pressed the attack, though they carried only revolvers. Within a few minutes, a fleet of police cars lit up the projects. The cops inside hunkered down behind the windows. Rather than racing to the scene, they crawled into Randall Avenue and slowed to a stop. The guns continued to blaze. And then silence. The police waited a further 10 minutes before getting out. The next morning, Pipe took up position on the corner. Word filtered back that no one had been killed. As Pipe waited, he saw a familiar figure ambling toward him. Kevin Bemo Aller, crackhead Bemo's son, wearing baggy camouflage pants, a black hoodie, and matching chukkas. Bemo always carried a thick wad of money in his back pocket. He had grown up with his grandmother in poverty, dealing with his father's addictions. Despite hailing from the enemy territory of Castle Hill, he had been adopted as a Soundview son. Pipe's father and Bemo's father had even done some business back in the day. Powerfully built under all his baggy layers, Bemo approached them outside 551. He knew about the war with E.T. Larry, he said in his husky monotone, explaining how he had been outselling his crack in black-topped vials when he'd also been warned off the block by Larry and his crew. Bemo and a friend had ambushed Lance and shot him twice in the legs, but the gun had jammed when they put it to his head. Chiron had tried to run him over in his car, then chased him with a gun. Bemo said he had come to stand with Pistol Pete. In the daylight, Pete, Pipe, and Shug saw the pox that their bullets had left in the buildings the previous night. The beef had now lasted 10 days. They went to the roof of 551, and Pete saw E.T. Larry and his men entering a store.
"These niggas think it's a game," he said, disgusted at their arrogance.
Pete figured that they wouldn't expect a daylight attack. The boys had become vampires, largely appearing at night to hunt down their foes while they watched Menace to Society and films like it during the day. This time Pete ripped an idea from Boys in the Hood.